facilities Lincoln might require, Fox brought Barnes to the White House. Lincoln told Barnes he wanted no luxuries, but only plain, simple food and ordinary comfort, that what was good for me would be good enough for him. Barnes returned to the Navy Yard to supervise the changes. The next morning, Lincoln summoned Barnes back to the White House, embarrassed at the thought that workers had stayed up all night to make alterations that might now require additional work. Lincoln explained apologetically that Mrs. Lincoln had decided that she would accompany him to City Point, and could the Bat accommodate her and her maidservant. Barnes was, in a sailor's phrase, taken all aback, knowing that the austere gunboat was in no respect adapted to the private life of womankind, nor could she be made so. He returned to the Navy Yard, where the alterations to the Bat were stopped, and the steamer River Queen was chartered. The change of plans was particularly upsetting to Fox, who expressed great regret that the determination of Mrs. Lincoln to accompany the president had forced the shift to an unarmed, fragile riverboat, so easily assailed and so vulnerable. He directed Barnes to follow Lincoln's steamer in the Bat, but still could not shake his anxiety. Though aware of the danger, Lincoln remained relaxed and cheerful, talking about the problems of accommodating womenfolk at sea in very funny terms. The presidential party, which included Army Captain Charles B. Penrose, Tad and Mary Lincoln, Mary's maid, and Lincoln's bodyguard, W.H. Crook, departed from the Arsenal Wharf at 6th Street at 1 p.m. on Thursday, March 23rd. Stanton had been laid up for several days, but against Ellen's advice, he took a carriage to see Lincoln off, arriving minutes after the River Queen's departure. Anxious about the president's safety, Stanton panicked an hour later when a hurricane swept over the city. The terrific squalls of winds, accompanied by thunder and lightning, did considerable damage here, the Herald's Washington correspondent reported. The roof of a factory on 6th Street was blown off into the street and fell upon a hack, crushing the horses and its driver. In some neighborhoods, trees were felled and houses destroyed, while down the river, the steamboats and sailing craft were dashed about with great violence. Leaving his bed once again, Stanton went to the War Department and telegraphed Lincoln at 8:45 p.m. "I hope you have reached Point Lookout safely, notwithstanding the furious gale that came on soon after you started. Please let me hear from you at Point Lookout." Lincoln, meanwhile, was enjoying himself immensely, while Tad raced around the ship, investigating every nook and befriending members of the crew. Lincoln remained on deck, watching the city until he could see it no more. Once inside, he listened with relish to the adventures of the River Queen's captain, who had chased blockade runners early in the war. "It was nearly midnight when he went to bed," Crook recalled. Crook, who shared a stateroom with Tad, was startled out of a sound sleep by Mary Lincoln. "It is growing colder," she explained, "and I came in to see if my little boy has covers enough on him." Later that night, Crook was awakened by the steamer passing through rough waters, which felt as if it were slowly climbing up one side of a hill and then rushing down the other. The next morning, still feeling seasick, Crook noted that the turbulent passage had apparently not disturbed Lincoln. On the contrary, the president looked rested, claimed to be feeling splendidly, and did full justice to the delicious fish served at breakfast. Mary would nostalgically recall her husband's fine humor during this last trip to City Point. Feeling so encouraged, the war was near its close, and relieved from the daily burdens of his office, he freely gave vent to his cheerfulness, to such an extent that he was almost boyish in his mirth, and reminded me of his original nature, what I had always remembered of him in our own home, free from care, surrounded by those he loved so well. Crook recalled that it was after dark on the 24th when the River Queen reached City Point. He would long remember the beauty of the scene that stretched before him, the many-colored lights of the boats in the harbor, and the lights of the town straggling up the high bluffs of the shore, crowned by the lights from Grant's headquarters at the top. Newly minted Captain Robert Lincoln escorted General and Mrs. Grant to call on the President shortly after he arrived. "Our gracious President met us at the gangplank," Julia Grant recalled, "greeted the General most heartily, and, giving me his arm, conducted us to where Mrs. Lincoln was awaiting." Leaving the two women together, the men went into the President's room for a short consultation, at the end of which, reported Crook, Mr. Lincoln appeared particularly happy, reassured by Grant's estimation that the conflict was nearing an end. After the Grants left, Lincoln and Mary, appearing in very good spirits, talked late into the night. While the Lincolns were breakfasting the next day on the lower deck, Robert came by to report that the review planned for that morning would have to be postponed. Rebels had initiated an attack on Fort Stedman, only 8 miles away. With Grant and Sherman closing in upon him, Lee had decided to abandon Petersburg and move his army south to North Carolina, hoping to join General Joseph Johnston and prevent Sherman from joining Grant. Abandoning Petersburg meant losing Richmond, but it was the only way to save his army. The attack on Fort Stedman, intended to open an escape route, took the Federals by surprise. Nonetheless, within hours, Grant's men succeeded in retaking the fort and restoring the original line. After breakfast, Lincoln walked up the bluff to Grant's headquarters, where plans were made for a visit to the front. As the presidential party passed by the battle sites, it became clear that the engagement had been more serious than first realized. "The ground immediately about us was still strewn with dead and wounded men," recalled Barnes. "The Confederates had suffered nearly 5,000 casualties, the Federals over 2,000. Burial parties were already at work, as ambulances transported the wounded to the hospital and surgeons attended those still lying in the field. When a long line of captured Confederate soldiers passed by, Lincoln remarked upon their sad and unhappy condition, his whole face showing sympathetic feeling for the suffering about him. On the return trip, he commented that he had seen enough of the horrors of war, that he hoped this was the beginning of the end, and that there would be no more bloodshed or ruin of homes. "I am here within 5 miles of the scene of this morning's action," Lincoln telegraphed Stanton from Meade's headquarters in the field. "I have seen the prisoners myself, and they look like there might be the number Meade states, 1,600. Unsettled by Lincoln's proximity to the front, Stanton replied, "I hope you will remember General Harrison's advice to his men at Tippecanoe, that they can see as well a little further off." But for the soldiers in the field who greeted him with heartfelt cheers, Lincoln's presence at the scene revealed that he was not afraid to show himself among them and willing to share their dangers here, as often, far away, he had shared the joy of their triumphs. Seated at the campfire that night, Lincoln seemed to Horace Porter much more grave and his language much more serious than usual. Undoubtedly, the grisly images of the dead and wounded were not easily dismissed. As the night wore on, the President rallied and entertained the General-in-Chief and several members of the staff by talking in a most interesting manner about public affairs and illustrating the subjects mentioned with his incomparable anecdotes. Toward the end of the evening, Grant asked, "Mr. President, did you at any time doubt the final success of the cause?" Never for a moment, Lincoln replied. Grant then turned the conversation to the Trent affair. According to Grant, Seward had given a very interesting account of the tangled questions involved during his visit the previous summer. Yes, said the president. Seward studied up all the works ever written on international law and came to cabinet meetings loaded to the muzzle with the subject. We gave due consideration to the case, but at that critical period of the war, it was soon decided to deliver up the prisoners. It was a pretty bitter pill to swallow, but I contented myself with believing that England's triumph in the matter would be short-lived, and that after ending our war successfully, we would be so powerful that we could call her to account for all the embarrassments she had inflicted upon us. Lincoln continued, I felt a good deal like the sick man in Illinois who was told he probably hadn't many days longer to live, and he ought to make his peace with any enemies he might have. He said the man he hated worst of all was a fellow named Brown in the next village. So Brown was sent for, and when he came, the sick man began to say, in a voice as meek as Moses's, that he wanted to die at peace with all his fellow creatures, and he hoped he and Brown could now shake hands and bury all their enmity. The scene was becoming altogether too pathetic for Brown, who had to get out his handkerchief and wipe the gathering tears from his eyes. After a parting that would have softened the heart of a grindstone, Brown had about reached the room door when the sick man rose up on his elbow and called out to him, But see here, Brown, if I should happen to get well, mind, that old grudge stands. So I thought that if this nation should happen to get well, we might want that old grudge against England to stand. Everyone laughed heartily, and the pleasant evening drew to a close. On Sunday morning, the River Queen carried the presidential party downriver to where Admiral Porter's naval flotilla awaited them. Ranged in double line, dressed with flags, the crews on deck cheering. As each vessel passed by, reported Barnes, Lincoln waved his high hat as if saluting old friends in his native town and seemed as happy as a schoolboy. After lunch aboard Porter's flagship, the River Queen sailed to Aiken's Landing. There, arrangements were made for Lincoln to ride on horseback with Grant to General Ord's encampment 4 miles away, while Mary Lincoln and Julia Grant followed in an ambulance. The president was in high spirits, observed Barnes, laughing and chatting, first to General Grant and then to General Ord, as they rode forward through the woods and over the swamps. Reaching the parade ground ahead of the ladies, they decided to begin the review without them, since the troops had been waiting for hours and had missed their midday meal. General Ord's wife, Mary, asked if it was proper for her to accompany the cavalcade without Mrs. Lincoln and Mrs. Grant. Of course, she was told. Come along. Meanwhile, the ambulance carrying the women had encountered great discomfort due to the corduroyed road, which jounced them into the air each time a log was struck. Concerned that the agonizingly slow pace would make them late for the review, Mary ordered the driver to go faster. This only made things worse, for the first jolt lifted the party clear off the seats, striking their heads on the top of the wagon. Mary now insisted on getting out and walking, recalled Horace Porter, who had been assigned to escort the ladies, but as the mud was nearly hub-deep, Mrs. Grant and I persuaded her that we had better stick to the wagon as our only ark of refuge. When Mary finally reached the parade grounds and saw the attractive Mrs. Ord riding beside her husband in the place of honor that should have been her own, she erupted in an embarrassing tirade against Mrs. Ord, calling her vile names in the presence of a crowd of officers. Mrs. Ord, according to one observer, burst into tears and inquired what she had done, but Mrs. Lincoln refused to be appeased and stormed till she was tired. Mrs. Grant tried to stand by her friend, and everybody was shocked and horrified. That evening, Mary continued her harangue at dinner, manifestly aggrieving her husband, whose attitude toward her, marveled Captain Barnes, was always that of the most affectionate solicitude, so marked, so gentle and unaffected, that no one could see them together without being impressed by it. Knowing his wife would awake the next morning humiliated by such a public display of temper, Lincoln had no desire to exacerbate the situation. Perhaps, as Mary's biographer suggests, the blow in the wagon that Mary suffered to her head had initiated a migraine headache, spurring the irrational outburst of wrath. Whether from illness or mortification, she remained sequestered in her stateroom for the next few days. At this time, General Sherman was on his way to City Point. His army had stopped in Goldsboro, North Carolina, to resupply, leaving him several days to visit Grant and discuss plans for the final push. When Sherman arrived, he and Grant eagerly greeted each other, their hands locked in a cordial grasp. To Horace Porter, their encounter was more like that of two schoolboys coming together after a vacation than the meeting of the chief actors in a great war tragedy. After talking for an hour, they walked down to the wharf and joined the president on the River Queen. Lincoln greeted Sherman with a warmth of manner and expression that the general would long remember, and initiated a lively conversation, intently questioning Sherman about his march from Savannah to Goldsboro. The talk darkened as Sherman and Grant agreed that one more bloody battle was likely to occur before the close of the war. They believed Lee's only option now was to retreat to the Carolinas. There, joining forces with Johnston, he would stage a desperate attack against either Sherman or Grant. "Must more blood be shed?" Lincoln asked. "Cannot this last bloody battle be avoided?" That was not in their hands, the generals explained. All would depend upon the actions taken by Robert E. Lee. The next morning, March 28th, Sherman and Grant, accompanied this time by Admiral Porter, returned to the River Queen for a long talk with Lincoln in the upper saloon. With the war drawing to a close, Sherman inquired of Lincoln, what was to be done with the rebel armies when defeated? And what should be done with the political leaders, such as Jeff Davis, etc.? Lincoln replied that all he wanted of us was to defeat the opposing armies and to get the men composing the Confederate armies back to their homes, at work on their farms and in their shops. He wanted no retaliation or retribution. Let them have their horses to plow with, and, if you like, their guns to shoot crows with. I want no one punished. Treat them liberally all round. We want those people to return to their allegiance to the Union and submit to the laws. Regarding Jefferson Davis and his top political leaders, Lincoln privately wished they could somehow escape the country, though he could not say this in public. As usual, Sherman recalled, he illustrated his meaning by a story. A man once had taken the total abstinence pledge. When visiting a friend, he was invited to take a drink, but declined on the score of his pledge. When his friend suggested lemonade, the man accepted. In preparing the lemonade, the friend pointed to the brandy bottle and said the lemonade would be more palatable if he were to pour in a little brandy. When his guest said, if he could do so unbeknown to him, he would not object. Sherman grasped the point immediately. Mr. Lincoln wanted Davis to escape unbeknown to him. Later that afternoon, Sherman left City Point to return to his troops and prepare for the expected battle. Saying goodbye to the president, he was more than ever impressed by his kindly nature, his deep and earnest sympathy with the afflictions of the whole people, and his absolute faith in the courage, manliness, and integrity of the armies in the field. to be sure. His face was careworn and haggard, but the moment he began to talk, his face lightened up, his tall form, as it were, unfolded, and he was the very impersonation of good humor and fellowship. A decade later, Sherman remained convinced of Lincoln's unparalleled leadership. "Of all the men I ever met, he seemed to possess more of the elements of greatness, combined with goodness, than any other." Lincoln walked to the railroad station early the next morning to bid farewell to Grant, who was heading to the front for what they hoped would be the final offensive against Lee. Oppressed by thoughts of the expected battle, Lincoln looked more serious than at any other time since he had visited headquarters, recalled Horace Porter. The lines in his face seemed deeper, and the rings under his eyes were of a darker hue. As the train pulled away from the platform, Grant and his party tipped their hats in honor of the president. Returning the salute, his voice broken by an emotion he could ill conceal, Lincoln said, "Goodbye, gentlemen. God bless you all." As Grant was leaving City Point, Seward was heading south to join Lincoln. "I think the president must have telegraphed for him," Wells surmised, "and if so, I came to the conclusion that efforts are again being made for peace. I am by no means certain that this irregular proceeding and importunity on the part of the executive is the wisest course." The Tribune concurred. "We presume no person of even average sagacity has imagined that the President of the United States had gone down to the front at such a time as this in quest merely of pleasure, or leisure, or health, even. That he hoped to bring peace with him on his return," the editorial suggested, "was too palpable to be doubted." Though Lincoln clearly would have loved to bring peace with him on his return, he went to City Point with no intention of engaging in further negotiations. He had, in fact, sought a change of air and rest, as well as the chance to escape the unceasing and relentless pressure of visitors. More important, he wanted to underscore his directive that Grant should converse with Lee only with regard to capitulation or solely military concerns. Grant was not to decide, discuss, or confer upon any political question. Such questions the president holds in his own hands. Lincoln wished to ensure that his lenient policy toward the rebels would not be undercut by a punitive agenda. He knew that work was accumulating on his desk as his second week of absence from Washington began, but he was not yet ready to return. "I begin to feel that I ought to be at home," he telegraphed Stanton on March 30th, "and yet I dislike to leave without seeing nearer to the end of General Grant's present movement. He has now been out since yesterday morning. Last night at 10:15, when it was dark as a rainy night without a moon could be, a furious cannonade, soon joined in by a heavy musketry fire, opened near Petersburg, and lasted about 2 hours. The sound was very distinct here, as also were the flashes of guns upon the clouds. It seemed to me a great battle, but the older hands here scarcely noticed it, and sure enough, this morning it was found that very little had been done." Stanton replied promptly, "I hope you will stay to see it out, or for a few days at least. I have strong faith that your presence will have great influence in inducing exertions that will bring Richmond. Compared to that, no other duty can weigh a feather. A pause by the army now would do harm. If you are on the ground, there will be no pause. All well here." Seward, who had most likely come to keep Lincoln company, remained only 2 days. On April 1st, he accompanied Mary back to Washington. The Lincolns had apparently decided that, after her public outburst, she would be better off in the White House, away from prying reporters. Moreover, Lincoln had related to her a dream in which the White House had caught fire, and Mary wanted to assure herself that all was well. Once she was aboard the steamer heading north, her spirits lifted abruptly. Fellow passenger Carl Schurz talked with her on the voyage. "She was overwhelmingly charming to me," he wrote to his wife. "She chided me for not visiting her, overpowered me with invitations, and finally had me driven to my hotel in her own state carriage. I learned more state secrets in a few hours than I could otherwise in a year. She is an astounding person." All that day, Lincoln haunted the telegraph office at City Point, anxiously awaiting news from Grant. Returning to the River Queen, he could see the flash of the cannon in the distance, signaling that the battle for Petersburg had begun. "Almost all night he walked up and down the deck," Crook recalled, pausing now and then to listen or to look out into the darkness to see if he could see anything. "I have never seen such suffering in the face of any man as was in his that night." The battle was intense, but by early morning the Federals had broken through Petersburg's outer lines of defense and had almost reached General Lee's headquarters at the Turnbull House. Realizing he could no longer hold on, Lee ordered his troops to withdraw from both Petersburg and Richmond. That evening, Lincoln received the news that Grant had Petersburg completely enveloped from river below to river above, and had taken about 12,000 prisoners. Grant invited the president to visit him in Petersburg the following day. Earlier that day, Lincoln had moved from the luxurious River Queen to the compact Malvern, Admiral Porter's flagship. Concerned by the cramped quarters, Porter had offered Lincoln his bed, but he positively declined it, Porter recalled, choosing instead the smallest kind of a room, 6 feet long by 4.5 feet wide. The next morning he insisted he had slept well, but teasingly remarked that, "You can't put a long blade into a short scabbard." Realizing that the president's 6'4" frame must have overhung the bed considerably, Porter got carpenters to knock down the wall, increasing the size of both the room and the bed. When Lincoln awoke the next morning, he announced with delight that, "A greater miracle than ever happened last night. I shrank 6 inches in length and about a foot sideways." To reach Grant, who was waiting in a comfortable-looking brick house with a yard in front on Market Street in Petersburg, Lincoln had to ride over the battlefields, littered with dead and dying soldiers. Years later, his bodyguard could recall the sight of one man with a bullet hole through his forehead and another with both arms shot away. As Lincoln absorbed the sorrowful scene, Crook noticed that his face settled into its old lines of sadness. By the time he reached Grant, he had recovered himself. Grant's aide, Horace Porter, watched as Lincoln dismounted in the street and came in through the front gate with long and rapid strides, his face beaming with delight. He seized General Grant's hand as the general stepped forward to greet him and stood shaking it for some time. Lincoln showed such elation that Porter doubted whether he had ever experienced a happier moment in his life. Lincoln and his lieutenant general conferred for about an hour and a half on the piazza in front of the house, while curious citizens strolled by. Though no word had arrived yet from Richmond, Grant surmised that with the fall of Petersburg, Lee had no choice but to evacuate the capital and move west along the Danville Road, hoping to escape to North Carolina, in which case the Federals would attempt to get ahead of him and cut him off. Grant had hoped to receive word of Richmond's fall while still in the president's company, but when no message arrived, he felt compelled to join his troops in the field. Lincoln was back at City Point when news reached him that Union troops commanded by General Weitzel had now occupied Richmond. "Thank God that I have lived to see this," he remarked to Admiral Porter. "It seems to me that I have been dreaming a horrid dream for 4 years, and now the nightmare is gone." For Jefferson Davis and the Confederate government, the nightmare was just beginning. 24 hours earlier, the Confederate president had received the devastating news of Lee's evacuation plans. Seated in his customary pew at St. Paul's Church for the Sunday service, Davis had received a telegram announcing that General Lee could not hold his position longer than till night, and warning him that we must leave Richmond as the army would commence retreating that evening. Thereupon, an attendant at the service noted, Davis instantly arose and walked hurriedly down the aisle beneath the questionings of all eyes in the house. Summoning his cabinet to an emergency session, he made preparations for a special train to carry the leading officials and important government papers south and west to Danville, where a new capital could be established. As word of the evacuation of the troops spread, the citizenry panicked, and a general exodus began. In the tumult, a small fire, deliberately set to destroy the tobacco warehouses before the Federals arrived, raged out of control, burning nearly everything between Main Street and the river for about 3/4 of a mile. All the public buildings in its path, including the offices of the Richmond Examiner and the Inquirer, were destroyed, leaving only the Custom House and the Spotswood Hotel. The news of Richmond's capture on April 3, 1865, reached the War Department in Washington shortly before noon. When over the wire came the words, "Here is the first message for you in 4 years from Richmond," the telegraph operator leaped from his seat and shouted from the window, "Richmond has fallen!" The news quickly spread by 1,000 mouths, and almost by magic the streets were crowded with hosts of people, talking, laughing, hurrahing, and shouting in the fullness of their joy. A Herald reporter noted that many wept as children, while men embraced and kissed each other upon the streets. Friends who had been estranged for years shook hands and renewed their vows of friendship. Gathering at the War Department, the crowd called for Stanton, who had not left his post for several nights. As he stood upon the steps to speak, recalled his aide, A.E. Johnson, he trembled like a leaf, and his voice showed his emotion. He began by expressing gratitude to Almighty God for his deliverance of the nation, then called for thanks to the President, to the Army and Navy, to the great commanders by sea and land, to the gallant officers and men who have periled their lives upon the battlefield and drenched the soil with their blood. Stanton was so overcome by emotion that he could not speak continuously, but when he finished, the crowd roared its approval. Seward, who had been at the War Department awaiting news of Richmond's fall, was urged to speak next. Clearly understanding that the moment belonged to Stanton, he kept his remarks short and humorous. He was beginning to think that it was time for a change in the cabinet, he began. "Why, I started to go to the front the other day, and when I got to City Point, they told me it was at Hatcher's Run. And when I got there, I was told it was not there, but somewhere else. And when I get back, I am told by the secretary that it is at Petersburg. But before I can realize that, I am told again that it is at Richmond, and west of that. Now I leave you to judge what I ought to think of such a secretary of war as this." The crowd erupted in loud and lusty cheers, and a beaming Stanton led them in a chorus of the Star-Spangled Banner. Newspapers raced to issue special editions. "The demand seemed inexhaustible," the Star reported, "and almost beyond the power of our lightning press to supply." 100 Herald couriers, as fleet on foot, and as breathless with enthusiasm as Malice with his fiery cross, raced to distribute papers in every section of the city. "Extra! Glorious! Fall of Richmond!" read the headlines, adding that black troops were among the first to enter the city. For anyone who missed the cries of the newsboys, the sound of 800 guns, fired at Stanton's order, marked the signal triumph. That night, with bands playing in the streets, candles sparkling in the windows of government buildings, and flags flying from every housetop, Seward joined a group of guests for dinner at Stanton's house. The evening's joy was diminished only by the anxiety Stanton and Seward shared for Lincoln's safety. Earlier that day, Seward had talked with James Speed about his fear that, if there were to be assassinations, now was the time. With the fall of Richmond, Seward told Speed, the Southern people would feel as though the world had come to an end. At such moments, history suggested, desperate men might be prompted to take desperate action, and the president, being the most marked man on the federal side, was the most liable to attack. Aware that Mary had invited Speed to join her 2 days later on a return trip to City Point, Seward begged him to warn the president of the danger. Stanton, who worried constantly about the president's safety, needed no reminders that the situation was more hazardous than ever. He had tried to keep Lincoln from going to Petersburg, asking him to consider whether you ought to expose the nation to the consequence of any disaster to yourself, and pointing out that while generals must run such risks in the line of their duty, political leaders were not in the same condition. Lincoln was already back from Petersburg when he received Stanton's telegram. He thanked the secretary for his concern and promised to take care of himself, while simultaneously announcing his intended departure for Richmond the next day. At 8 a.m. on Tuesday morning, April 4th, Lincoln set forth on his historic journey to Richmond. When the Malvern reached the channel approaching the city, its passage was blocked by wreckage of all sorts, including dead horses, broken ordnance, wrecked boats, and floating torpedoes. They were forced to transfer to the captain's barge, which was towed in behind a little tug manned by Marines. When the tug went aground, the president's arrival was left to the rowing skills of a dozen sailors. The situation was unnerving to Crook. "On either side," he recalled, "we passed so close to torpedoes that we could have put out our hands and touched them." "Here we were, in a solitary boat," Admiral Porter remembered, "after having set out with a number of vessels, flying flags at every masthead, hoping to enter the conquered capital in a manner befitting the rank of the President of the United States." Lincoln was not disturbed in the slightest. The situation reminded him, he cheerfully noted, of a man who had approached him seeking a high position as a consulate minister. Finding he could not get that, he came down to some more modest position. Finally, he asked to be made a tide waiter. When he saw he could not get that, he asked me for an old pair of trousers. But it is well to be humble. No sooner had the presidential party reached the landing than Lincoln was surrounded by a small group of black laborers shouting, "Bless the Lord! There is the great Messiah! Glory hallelujah!" First one and then several others fell on their knees. "Don't kneel to me," Lincoln said, his voice full of emotion. "That is not right. You must kneel to God only, and thank him for the liberty you will hereafter enjoy." The men stood up, joined hands, and began to sing a hymn. The streets, which had been entirely deserted, became suddenly alive with crowds of black people tumbling and shouting from over the hills and from the waterside. An ever-growing crowd trailed Lincoln as he walked up the street. It was a warm day, Admiral Porter noted, and Lincoln, whose tall figure overtopped every man there, was easily visible. From the windows of the houses along the two-mile route, hundreds of white faces looked on with curiosity at the lanky figure, walking with his usual long, careless stride, and looking about with an interested air, and taking in everything. Lincoln's bodyguard was relieved when they finally reached the safety of General Weitzel's headquarters, for he thought he had glimpsed a figure in Confederate uniform pointing a gun at Lincoln from a window along the route. Weitzel and his officers had occupied the stucco mansion that Jefferson Davis had abandoned only 2 days earlier. Captain Barnes recalled that when Lincoln walked into the comfortably furnished office of the Confederate president, he crossed the room to the easy chair and sank down in it. To all present, it seemed a supreme moment. But Lincoln betrayed no sense of exaltation or triumph. His first words, softly spoken, were simply to ask for a glass of water. The water was promptly supplied, along with a bottle of whiskey. An old black servant still at his post told them that Mrs. Davis had ordered him to have the house in good condition for the Yankees. Lincoln had already toured the mansion, seeming interested in everything, and had met with the members of General Weitzel's staff when the Confederate Assistant Secretary of War, John Campbell, arrived to see him. Lincoln welcomed Campbell, whom he had met 2 months earlier at the Hampton Roads Conference. While the details of their conversation were later disputed, it appears that Lincoln, still fearing that Lee might engage in a final battle, agreed to allow the Virginia legislature to convene on the understanding that they would repeal the order of secession and remove the state's troops from the war. Riding through the city that afternoon in an open carriage, the president and his entourage found the Confederate State House in dreadful disorder, signs of a sudden and unexpected flight. Members' tables were upset, bales of Confederate scrip were lying about the floor, and many official documents of some value were scattered about. When they finally returned to the flagship, both Admiral Porter and William Crook were greatly relieved. Having worried all day about Lincoln's safety, Crook later wrote that it was nothing short of miraculous that some attempt on Lincoln's life was not made. It is to the everlasting glory of the South that he was permitted to come and go in peace. As Lincoln rested on the Malvern that night, all the public buildings in the nation's capital were illuminated by order of the Secretary of State. The city was all alight with rockets, fireworks, and illuminations of every description, observed Noah Brooks, the streets being one blaze of glory. It seemed the entire population of Washington had poured into the streets to share in the triumph and view the brilliant spectacle produced by thousands of lighted candles. Though Seward joined in the glorious celebrations, he continued to fret. The following day, he told Wells that he had secured a revenue cutter to take him to Richmond with some important papers that required the president's immediate attention. "He is filled with anxiety to see the president," Wells recorded in his diary, "and these schemes are his apology." Minutes after taking leave of Wells, Seward nearly lost his life in a carriage accident. Fanny and her friend Mary Titus had come to the department to join her father and brother Fred for their customary afternoon ride. As the horses moved up Vermont Avenue, the coachman stopped to close the carriage door, which had not been properly latched. Before he could return to his seat, the horses bolted, swinging the driver by the reins as one would swing a cat by the tail. Both Fred and Seward jumped out, hoping they could stop the runaway horses. Fred was not hurt, but Seward caught his heel on the carriage as he jumped and landed violently upon the pavement, causing him to lose consciousness. "The horses tore along," Fanny recorded in her diary, "and we seemed to be whirling on to certain destruction. At an alley, they turned, we brushed against a tree, and headed straight toward the corner of a house where she feared she would be crushed to death. Fortunately, a passing soldier got control of the reins and brought an end to the terrifying ride. Rushing back to the place where her father had fallen, Fanny was horrified to find his broken body, blood streaming from his mouth. At first she feared he was dead. For 2 hours after he was carried to his home, Seward remained unconscious. When he came to at last, he was delirious with pain, having suffered a broken jaw and a badly dislocated shoulder. Doctors arrived, and Fanny could hear his agonized cries through the bedroom door. When she was finally allowed to see him, he was so disfigured by bruises that he had scarcely a trace of resemblance to himself. Hearing the news, Stanton rushed to Seward's bedside, where, Fanny recalled, he was like a woman in the sick room. He ministered carefully to his friend, perhaps remembering childhood days when he had accompanied his father on sick calls. He wiped his lips, where the blood had caked, spoke gently to him, and remained by his side for hours. Returning to the War Department, Stanton sent Lincoln a telegram at City Point. Mr. Seward was thrown from his carriage, his shoulder bone at the head of the joint broken off, his head and face much bruised, and he is, in my opinion, dangerously injured. I think your presence here is needed. Receiving the message shortly before midnight, Lincoln advised Grant that Seward's accident necessitated his return to Washington. Meanwhile, Mary and her invited guests, including James Speed, Elizabeth Keckley, Charles Sumner, Senator Harlan, and the Marquis de Chambrun, were steaming toward City Point. At dawn the next morning, Mary sent a telegram to Stanton. If Mr. Seward is not too severely injured, cannot the President remain until we arrive at City Point? By this time, the Surgeon General had determined that Seward had suffered no internal injuries. Stanton informed Mary that there was no objection to the President remaining at City Point. A few hours later, he sent word to Lincoln that Seward was recovering. I have seen him and read him all the news. His mind is clear and spirits good. When Mary's party arrived at noon on April 6th, Lincoln brought them into the drawing room of the River Queen and relayed the latest bulletins, all positive, from Grant. His whole appearance, pose, and bearing had marvelously changed, Senator Harlan noted. He was, in fact, transfigured. That indescribable sadness, which had previously seemed to be an adamantine element of his very being, had been suddenly changed for an equally indescribable expression of serene joy, as if conscious that the great purpose of his life had been attained. Nonetheless, the Marquis marveled, it was impossible to detect in him the slightest feeling of pride, much less of vanity. While the visitors went off to Richmond, Lincoln remained at City Point to await further word from Grant. Welcome news soon arrived. A copy of a telegram from Sheridan, reporting a successful engagement with Lee's retreating armies that had resulted in the capture of several thousand prisoners, including a half-dozen generals. If the thing is pressed, Sheridan predicted, I think Lee will surrender. Lincoln rejoined, let the thing be pressed. That evening, Julia Grant, accompanied by Lincoln's old friend E.B. Washburn, joined the Lincoln party on the River Queen. The conversation turned on what should be done with Jefferson Davis if he were apprehended. Don't allow him to escape the law, one of the group said. He must be hung. At once, Lincoln interjected, let us judge not, that we be not judged. On Saturday morning, Lincoln and his guests visited Petersburg. At a certain spot, the Marquis recalled, he gave orders to stop the carriage. On his previous visit, Lincoln had noticed a very tall and beautiful oak tree that he wanted to examine more closely. He admired the strength of its trunk, the vigorous development of branches, which reminded him of the great oaks in the western forests. He halted the carriage again when they passed an old country graveyard, where trees shaded a carpet of spring flowers. Turning to his wife, Lincoln said, "Mary, you are younger than I. You will survive me. When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." On the train ride back to City Point, Lincoln observed a turtle basking in the warm sunshine on the wayside. He asked that the train be stopped so that the turtle could be brought into the car. "The movements of the ungainly little animal seemed to delight him," Elizabeth Keckley recalled. "He and Tad shared a happy laugh all the way back to the wharf." Such distractions could not forestall the afternoon's grim task. Lincoln visited injured soldiers at City Point. Moving from one bed to another, the Marquis recalled, saying a friendly word to each wounded man, or at least giving him a handshake. At one bed, he held the hand of a 24-year-old captain who had been cited for bravery. The dying man half opened his eyes. A faint smile passed over his lips. It was then that his pulse ceased beating. Lincoln remained among the wounded for 5 hours and returned to the steamer depleted. "There has been war enough," he said, when the Marquis inquired about troubles with France over Mexico. "During my second term, there will be no more fighting." That evening, as the River Queen prepared to return to Washington, Grant's officers and staff came to say farewell. Lincoln had hoped to remain at City Point until Lee's surrender, but he felt he should visit Seward. As the twilight shadows deepened, the lamps were lighted, and the boat was brilliantly illuminated, Elizabeth Keckley recalled. It looked like an enchanted floating palace. When the military band came aboard, Lincoln asked them to play La Marseillaise in honor of the Marquis de Chambrun. As the River Queen steamed toward Washington on Sunday, the conversation, Chambrun recalled, dwelt upon literary subjects. Holding a beautiful quarto copy of Shakespeare in his hands, Lincoln read several passages from Macbeth, including the king's pained tribute to the murdered Duncan. "Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further." Lincoln read the lines slowly, marveling how true a description of the murderer that one was. When the dark deed achieved, its tortured perpetrator came to envy the sleep of his victim. And when he finished, he read over again the same scene. Lincoln's ominous selection prompted James Speed to deliver Seward's warning about the increased threat upon his life. "He stopped me at once," Speed recalled, "saying he had rather be dead than to live in continual dread." Moreover, he considered it essential that the people know I come among them without fear. Early that evening, the steamer passed by Mount Vernon, prompting Chambrun to say to Lincoln, "Mount Vernon and Springfield, the memories of Washington and your own, those of the Revolutionary and Civil Wars, these are the spots and names America shall one day equally honor." The remark brought a dreamy smile to Lincoln's face. "Springfield," he said, "how happy 4 years hence will I be to return there in peace and tranquility." Years later, Chambrun remained intrigued by Lincoln's temperament. On first impression, he left you with a sort of impression of vague and deep sadness. Yet he was quite humorous, often telling hilarious stories and laughing uproariously. But all of a sudden he would retire within himself. Then he would close his eyes, and all his features would at once bespeak a kind of sadness as indescribable as it was deep. After a while, as though it were by an effort of his will, he would shake off this mysterious weight under which he seemed bowed. His generous and open disposition would again reappear. Lincoln's bodyguard, William Crook, believed he understood something of the shifting moods that mystified the French aristocrat. He had observed that Lincoln seemed to absorb the horrors of the war into himself. In the course of the 2-week trip, Crook had witnessed Lincoln's agony when the thunder of the cannon told him that men were being cut down like grass. He had seen the anguish on the president's face when he came within sight of the poor, torn bodies of the dead and dying on the field of Petersburg. He discerned his painful sympathy with the forlorn rebel prisoners, and his profound distress at the revelation of the devastation of a noble people in ruined Richmond. In each instance, Lincoln had internalized the pain of those around him, the wounded soldiers, the captured prisoners, the defeated Southerners. Little wonder that he was overwhelmed at times by a profound sadness that even his own resilient temperament could not dispel. Directly upon his return to Washington, Lincoln went to Seward's bedside. It was in the evening, Fred Seward recalled. The gas lights were turned down low, and the house was still, everyone moving softly and speaking in whispers. His father had taken a turn for the worse. A high fever had developed, and grave apprehensions were entertained by his medical attendants that his system would not survive the injuries and the shock. Frances had hurried down from Auburn to find her husband in a more serious state than she had imagined, his face so marred and swollen and discolored that one can hardly persuade themselves of his identity, his voice so changed, utterance almost entirely prevented by the broken jaw and the swollen tongue. It makes my heart ache to look at him. His mind was perfectly clear, however, and he remained, as always, patient and uncomplaining. The extreme sensitiveness of the wounded arm, Fred recalled, made even the touch of the bedclothing intolerable. To keep it free from their contact, he was lying on the edge of the bed, farthest from the door. When Lincoln entered the room, he walked over to the far side of the bed and sat down near the bandaged patient. "You are back from Richmond?" Seward queried in a halting, scarcely audible voice. "Yes," Lincoln replied, "and I think we are near the end at last." To continue the conversation more intimately, Lincoln stretched out on the bed. Supporting his head with his hand, Lincoln lay side by side with Seward, as they had done at the time of their first meeting in Massachusetts many years before. When Fanny came in to sit down, Lincoln somehow managed to unfold his long arm and bring it around the foot of the bed to shake hands in his cordial way. He related the details of his trip to Richmond, where he had worked as hard at the task of shaking 7,000 hands as he had when he sawed wood, and seemed, Fanny thought, much satisfied at the labor. Finally, when he saw that Seward had fallen into a much-needed sleep, Lincoln quietly got up and left the room. Drained by Seward's grievous condition, Lincoln revived when Stanton burst into the White House bearing a telegram from Grant, "General Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia this afternoon, upon terms proposed by myself." It was later said that the President hugged him with joy upon hearing the news, and then went immediately to tell Mary. Although it was close to 10 p.m., Stanton knew that Seward would want to be awakened for this news. "God bless you," Seward said when Stanton read the telegram. This was the third time Stanton had come to see Seward that Sunday. "Don't try to speak," Stanton said. "You have made me cry," for the first time in my life," Seward replied. Both Grant and Lee had acquitted themselves admirably at the courtly surrender ceremony that afternoon at the Appomattox Courthouse. One general, magnanimous in victory, historian J. Winnick writes, the other, gracious and equally dignified in defeat. 2 days earlier, Grant had sent a note to Lee asking him to surrender. In light of the result of the last week, Grant wrote, he hoped that Lee understood the hopelessness of further resistance and would choose to prevent any further effusion of blood. At first, Lee refused to accept the futility of his cause, contemplating one last attempt to escape. But Sunday morning, with his troops almost completely surrounded, Lee sent word to Grant that he was ready to surrender. As the distinguished silver-haired general dressed for the historic meeting, his biographer writes, he put on his handsomest sword and his sash of deep red silk. Thinking it likely he would be imprisoned before the day's end, he told General William Pendleton, I must make my best appearance. He need not have worried, for Grant was determined to follow Lincoln's lenient guidelines. The terms of surrender allowed Confederate officers, after relinquishing their arms and artillery, to return to their homes, not to be disturbed by the United States authority, on the condition that they never take up arms against the Union until properly exchanged. As Grant continued to work out the terms, he later recalled, the thought occurred to me that the officers had their own private horses and effects, which were important to them, but of no value to us. Also, that it would be an unnecessary humiliation to call upon them to deliver their sidearms. He therefore added a provision allowing officers to take their sidearms as well as their private horses and baggage. This permission, Lee observed, would have a happy effect upon his army. Before the two men parted, Lee mentioned that his army was in a very bad condition for want of food. Grant responded immediately, promising to send rations for 25,000 men. As Lee rode back to his headquarters, word of the surrender spread through the Confederate lines. He tried to speak to his men, but tears came into his eyes, and he could manage to say only, "Men, we have fought the war together, and I have done the best I could for you." If Lee had trouble expressing his grief and pride, his soldiers showed no such reservations. In an overwhelming display of respect and devotion, they spontaneously arranged themselves on each side of the road to greet him as he passed, and two solid walls of men were formed along the whole distance. When their cheers brought tears to Lee's eyes, they too began to weep. Each group began in the same way, with cheers, and ended in the same way, with sobs, all along the route to his quarters. One soldier spoke for all, "I love you just as well as ever, General Lee." At dawn the next day, Noah Brooks heard a great boom. The reverberation of a 500-gun salute startled the misty air of Washington, shaking the very earth and breaking the windows of houses about Lafayette Square. The morning newspapers would carry the details, but this was Secretary Stanton's way of telling the people that the Army of Northern Virginia had, at last, laid down its arms. "The nation seems delirious with joy," noted Wells. "Guns are firing, bells ringing, flags flying, men laughing, children cheering, all jubilant. This surrender of the great rebel captain and the most formidable and reliable army of the secessionists virtually terminates the rebellion." A spontaneous holiday was announced in all departments. Employees poured into the streets. an exuberant crowd of several thousand gathered at the White House. The bands played, the howitzers belched forth their thunder, and the people cheered, reported the National Intelligencer. Despite shouted demands for him to speak, Lincoln hesitated. He was planning a speech for the following evening and did not want to dribble it all out before he completed his thoughts. If he said something mistaken, it would make its way into print, and a person in his position, he modestly said, ought at least try not to make mistakes. Still, the crowd was so insistent that the president finally appeared at the second-story window, where he was received in the most enthusiastic manner, the people waving their hats, swinging their umbrellas, and the ladies waving their handkerchiefs. When the assembly quieted down, Lincoln acknowledged their euphoria with a smile of his own. "I am very greatly rejoiced to find that an occasion has occurred so pleasurable that the people cannot restrain themselves." These words drew even wilder cheers. Lincoln then announced a special request for the band. "I have always thought Dixie one of the best tunes I have ever heard," he began. "Our adversaries over the way attempted to appropriate it, but I insisted yesterday that we fairly captured it." This was followed by tumultuous applause. I presented the question to the Attorney General, and he gave it as his legal opinion that it is our lawful prize. I now request the band to favor me with its performance. In requesting the patriotic song of the South, Lincoln believed that it is good to show the rebels that, with us, they will be free to hear it again. The band followed Dixie with Yankee Doodle, and the crowd went off in high good humor. "If possible," Mary wrote, "this is a happier day than last Monday," when the news of Richmond's capture had reached Washington. Her exhilaration was evident in a note she wrote to Charles Sumner the next morning, inviting him and the Marquis to join her in a carriage ride around the city, to see the grand illumination and to hear the President speak. "It does not appear to me," she wrote, "that this womanly curiosity will be undignified or indiscreet. Qu'en pensez-vous?" Illuminated once again, the city was spectacular to behold. The windows of every government building were ablaze with candles and lanterns, and the lights of the newly completed Capitol Dome were visible for miles around. Bonfires blazed in many parts of the city, and rockets were fired in ongoing celebrations. Knowing the president was going to address the public, Stanton put his men to work decorating the front of the War Department with flags, corps badges, and evergreens. When Lincoln came to a second-story window on the north side of the White House, he carried a roll of manuscript in his hand. He had explained to Noah Brooks that this was a precaution against colloquial expressions that might offend men such as Charles Sumner, who had objected previously to phrases such as "the rebels turned tail and ran," or "sugar-coated pill." At the sight of the president, the immense crowd's enthusiasm was loosed in wave after wave of applause, requiring him to stand still for some time until the din subsided. "The speech," Noah Brooks observed, "was longer than most people had expected, and of a different character." Instead of simply celebrating the moment, Lincoln wanted to address the national debate surrounding the reintroduction of the Southern states into the Union. "The greatest question," he still believed, "ever presented to practical statesmanship." He acknowledged that in Louisiana, where the process had already begun, some were disappointed that in the new state constitution, the elective franchise is not given to the colored man. He felt the right of suffrage should be extended to blacks, to to those who are literate and those who serve our cause as soldiers. On the other hand, the new Louisiana Constitution contained a number of remarkable provisions. It emancipated all the slaves within the state and provided the benefit of public schools equally to black and white. The state legislature, which had already revealed its good intentions by ratifying the 13th Amendment, was empowered specifically to confer the elective franchise upon the colored men. Were they to cast out the hard work already achieved, Lincoln asked rhetorically, or trust that this was the start of a process that would eventually produce a complete success? Relying on a simple, rustic image to convey the complex question, he wondered if we shall sooner have the fowl by hatching the egg than by smashing it. In the crowd that evening was Confederate sympathizer John Wilkes Booth. The younger brother of the famed Shakespearean actor Edwin Booth, whose performances Lincoln so admired, Wilkes had also acquired popularity as an actor. Unlike his older brother, who supported the Union, John Wilkes had spent the most formative years of his youth in the South and had developed an abiding passion for the rebels' cause. In recent months, this passion had become a full-blown obsessive hatred for the North. Since the previous summer, he and a small group of conspirators had evolved a plan to kidnap Lincoln and bring him to Richmond, where he could be exchanged for rebel prisoners of war. The capture of Richmond and the surrender of Lee rendered the plan useless, but Booth was not ready to yield. "Our cause being almost lost," he wrote in his diary, "something decisive and great must be done." Two other conspirators were with Booth in the crowd: drugstore clerk David Herold and former Confederate soldier Lewis Powell, also known as Lewis Payne. When Lincoln spoke of his desire to extend suffrage to blacks, Booth turned to Powell. "That means nigger citizenship. That is the last speech he will ever make," he said. He pleaded with Powell to shoot Lincoln then and there. When Powell demurred, Booth proclaimed, "By God, I'll put him through." Curiously, Lincoln had recently experienced a dream that carried ominous intimations. "There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me," Lincoln purportedly told Ward Lemon. "Then I heard subdued sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. I went from room to room. No living person was in sight, but the same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. Determined to find the cause of a state of things so mysterious and so shocking, I kept on until I arrived at the East Room, which I entered. There, I met with a sickening surprise. Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers who were acting as guards, and there was a throng of people, some gazing mournfully upon the corpse, whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. 'Who is dead in the White House?' I demanded of one of the soldiers. 'The president,' was his answer. 'He was killed by an assassin.'" Lemon also described what he claimed was the president's attempt to evade the dire portent of the dream. "Don't you see how it will turn out?" Lincoln comforted Lemon. "In this dream, it was not me, but some other fellow that was killed." "Well, let it go. I think the Lord, in his own good time and way, will work this out all right. God knows what is best." Historian Don Fehrenbacher is persuasive that Lemon's chronology is confused, which casts doubt on the veracity of the entire story. Yet Lincoln's penchant for portentous dreams, and his tendency to relate them to others were remarked on by many of his intimate acquaintances. While radicals, including Sumner and Chase, believed that universal suffrage should be mandated, rebel leaders should be punished, and the federal government should assume control of the seceded states, a large majority of the people approved of Lincoln's speech. Reunion, according to Noah Brooks, was then the foremost thought in the minds of men. Lincoln's support for the quickly assembled imperfect governments in Louisiana and elsewhere drew further criticism from radicals. He believed there must be courts and law and order, or society would be broken up, the disbanded armies would turn into robber bands and guerrillas. That same belief had informed his conversations with Judge Campbell in Richmond, and his conditional permission for the old Virginia legislature to assemble. At the time of their meeting, 5 days before Lee's surrender, Lincoln had hoped the Virginians would vote to take back the order of secession and remove Virginia's troops from the war. He also felt that it was sound policy to let the prominent and influential men of their respective counties come together and undo their own work. Lincoln's cabinet strongly disagreed with the idea of letting the rebel legislature assemble for any reason. In Seward's absence, Stanton assumed center stage, telling Lincoln that to place such powers in the Virginia legislature would be giving away the scepter of the conqueror, that it would transfer the result of victory of our arms from the field to the very legislatures which 4 years before had said, "Give us war," that it would put the government in the hands of its enemies, that it would surely bring trouble with Congress. Stanton insisted that any effort to reorganize the government should be under federal authority solely, treating the rebel organizations and government as absolutely null and void. Attorney General Speed expressed his accord with Stanton's assessment in the meeting and afterward privately with Lincoln. The president confessed to Welles that the opposition of Speed and Stanton troubled him tremendously. Welles provided no relief. He, too, doubted the policy of convening a rebel legislature, and predicted that, once convened, they would, with their hostile feelings, be inclined, perhaps, to conspire against us. Lincoln still disagreed, maintaining that if prominent Virginians were to come together, they would turn themselves and their neighbors into good Union men. Nonetheless, Welles said, as we had all taken a different view, he had perhaps made a mistake, and was ready to correct it if he had. Lincoln's thinking was further influenced by a telegram from Campbell to General Weitzel, which suggested that Campbell was indeed assuming more powers for the legislature than he and Lincoln had originally discussed. In the late afternoon of April 12th, Lincoln walked over to the War Department to confer again with Stanton. Stanton's clerk, A.E. Johnson, recalled that Lincoln sat on the sofa and listened intently, while Stanton, full of feeling, reiterated his passionate opposition to allowing the legislature to convene, warning that the fate of the emancipated millions would be left in